I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source at what we'll call the Ferguson moment of awakening to patterns of racial division in this country. Two nations, separate and unequal, as foretold in the late 1960s. Today, between black and white households, the ownership gap is 20 to 1 and widening. The unemployment gap is double and holding steady. The college degree gap is almost double. The incarceration rate is 6 times higher for black men than white. The death by murder rate is 10 times higher. The chance of dying at the hands of black or white policemen is 21 times higher for blacks than whites. The chance of white police officers being charged criminally for killing unarmed black men is close to zero, as the world is learning from the Michael Brown case in Missouri this summer, and now the non-indictment of the New York police officer who killed Eric Garner by chokehold. Most of the trend lines on equality have been moving in the wrong direction for years, since 9/11, since the end of the Civil Rights Movement. But now there's no way not to notice them. In the New York and Ferguson street protests, the note has been outrage, but not despair. So what are we learning? We've asked our three guests this hour to share personal histories and lessons. Brandon Terry is a young social scientist with a philosophical turn of mind at Harvard who grew up black in divided Baltimore, scene of the Wire series on HBO and the podcast hit Serial. He says the master question in his mind is, how did Baltimore get that way? Jacqueline Rivers is many years a mother and education activist in Dorchester, also a new PhD from Harvard, and a contributor to Orlando Patterson's big new study of the cultural matrix, and Professor Glenn Lowry of Brown University, an economist by discipline who's written also with personal passion about growing up poor on the South Side of Chicago and about black incarceration as policy in America today. First, we asked people in downtown Boston this week if they could explain what happened in Ferguson.
One good thing that's coming out of this is the issue of police brutality all over the country.
I'm not feeling that white boy gunning them down like that, but that brother wasn't totally innocent. But a lot of people just ain't feeling it, and they're taking their rage out.
I feel like it's very, very sad what happened to him.
I think it's racist.
Real racist. That cop should get locked up for some years.
Wait, what happened to me?
The system's f***ed up, you know?
I don't know if it can never end, but can you learn tolerance? Can you learn how to live together? I mean, we're probably anciently programmed to be worried about the other.
Now, I say to you, Ferguson is an example of the way it is here. It is simply the way that it is. It is the reality that is ignored until some innocent or not so innocent person, generally black and male, is slain in the street under a badge. A badge that follows every black male across this country throughout their life. It is a tale that haunts us, that you are hated, you are despised from birth, for no better reason than your color. I am one of them.
Brandon Terry, you grew up in the city of Baltimore, called Bodymore, Murderland, in David Simon's breakthrough series, The Wire. That experience forms your quest as a scholar. Take us through your thinking in this year of Ferguson.
Well, I think the starting off point is an image that I think is the most searing to come out of this entire unfolding of events. And it's the decision that the cable networks made to air the president's remarks on Ferguson alongside the eruption of violence on the street immediately after the announcement that they weren't going to indict Darren Wilson. And I think that the juxtaposition of those two images captures better than anything else a sort of dialectic, the tension between hope and nihilism that characterize our moment, our contemporary black politics and our politics of race. And you know, it seems a long way away from 2008, but I think if we are honest with ourselves, we look back at that moment as one where the horizon of black political expectations were really, really expanded after a long period of depression and disappointment. And what we're seeing now is the confrontation of those heightened expectations with the recalcitrance of racial inequity in this country, racial injustice, mm-hmm. and the response, right, to people realizing that, you know, it's going to take more than increased hope and increased expectation to dislodge these enduring structures of racial injustice is shaping our moment. And we see what happens when the frustration boils over, when people don't think our politics has any reasonable avenue for their energy, their attempt to realize safety and security and the rights of life, liberty and the pursuit of happiness that this nation promises. But we also are seeing, and I think much more promisingly, people trying to navigate between, you know, this sort of old hope and, well, Obama can fix all of this on his own, and the kind of nihilism you see in the streets of Ferguson as people are burning and looting and turning over police cars, where a lot of activists are trying to generate a new matrix of political organizing that can fight what W.E.B. Du Bois called a long time ago the long siege, right? The long enduring battle to have the kind of civil society that can hold elected officials accountable, that can generate the kind of money that we need to fight legal battles, that can train the activists, the lawyers, the politicians, the other sort of strategists to win these games over the long haul, because every little victory is going to have to be defended and pushed further and further in order to erase this centuries-long set of injustices.
Nurturing the scholars, too, like you. You have navigated an interesting line yourself growing up, and I wish you'd just share a little bit about it, complexity
sure.
of your own family, your own ambition, and how are you going to handle all this?
Sure. I was born in Baltimore, and like a lot of people in the city, my family has had its fair share of contact with the criminal justice system. Both of my brothers were incarcerated for most of my youth. And, you know, they were living in a city where at one point there were health department estimates that up to 10% of the city was addicted to heroin, right? That was our chief industry.
Well, that's right. What David Simon has popularized that notion, that
right.
This is a city prepared to deal in drugs forever.
Right. And so you saw this, but what was always fascinating about it is that you saw the stark racial divide that characterized the city, and that there were all sorts of people who used drugs, but the most severe consequences, the most enduring tragedy seemed to fall disproportionately on black people in Baltimore. And, you know, we were growing up where at that time the murder rate was, you know, 350 murders a year. So it was full of violence. It was it felt dangerous. It felt threatening. It felt like a city on the brink of a real disaster. But we've also got to understand how we pull back from the edge.
But you have connection on the law side, too, I gather.
Right, right. My ex-brother-in-law was a homicide detective for many years has been a homicide detective for many years in Baltimore and was a narcotics detective before that. And, you know, I could see things from both sides. So one of the things that really frustrates me about the debate that we see is that it's still mired in a very old notion of the politics of respectability. We're sort of constantly adjudicating, well, is Mike Brown a thug? Is he a hero? Is he a saint? And when you see things from both sides, is Darren Wilson a thug with a badge, or is he some kind of hero or saint? When you see things from both sides, you realize the serious complexities of the issue. You see that, you know, I could watch my brother-in-law wake up every morning, and his job was to pick a young black man out of the street who looked like him. And try to solve a murder in a community where people are so distrustful of police that they're not always willing to help you solve the murder. They're always worried about the consequences of trying to help solve the murder, right? Does the Baltimore Police Department have enough funds for witness protection? Can they even really win the conviction that you need. If, you know, in these other cases, not just murder cases, but do you really want to send people away for 30 years, 40 years, 50 years for the crimes they commit? So these are all questions that are sort of haunting us. And on the other side, you sort of see, well, when your brothers are involved in these kinds of things and your family's involved in these kinds of things, you realize the moral ambiguity, the complexity. Mm-hmm. You see what people are going through when they lose their jobs, what people are going through when they're dealing with emotional and physical abuse and trying to salve that pain with drug addictions and other vices.
From Ferguson, from a distance, what we see is a city that sort of preys upon itself in many complicated ways, but it also finances its minimal services by arresting people and then charging them extra for being late with their fines or their warrants. Somebody figured out that there were 3 warrants issued on every household every year.
Right, the Arch City Defenders report.
Yeah. I mean, what does that tell you? And do you see Ferguson everywhere? Do you see that sort of predatory system in your hometown?
Right. Well, you got to go back to, I think, here's where Martin Luther King had the perfect analysis toward the end of his life. You see a convergence of militarism, white supremacy, and unchecked capitalism, right? So these communities, it was funny to see everyone up in arms about the burning down of the stores, but not similarly outraged by the fact that these communities have been gutted by, corporate practices for a long time, right? These are communities where deregulation has allowed corporations to move jobs offshore, to defund the government, right? Mm-hmm. And you've got so much pressure on these local municipalities that they're looking for any way they can to fund their jurisdictions.
I mean, it makes you wonder if anybody is winning anything. Coming up, racist structures and adaptive cultures that feed on each other in Black daily life. We're talking about what Cornel West long ago called nihilism in Black America with Glenn Lowry and Jacqueline Rivers. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. From 50 years ago, this was the immortal essayist James Baldwin speaking at Cambridge University on the trials of Black manhood.
By the time you are 30, you have been through a certain kind of mill. And the most serious effect of the mill you've been through is, again, not the catalog of disaster. The policemen, the taxi drivers, the waiters, the landlady, the landlord, the banks, the insurance companies, the millions of details, 24 hours of every day, which spell out to you that you are a worthless human being. It is not that. It is by that time you've begun to see it happening in your daughter or your son or your niece or your nephew. You are 30 by now, and nothing you have done has helped you to escape the trap. But what is worse than that is that nothing you have done, and as far as you can tell, nothing you can do, will save your son or your daughter from meeting the same disaster and not impossibly coming to the same end.
That was James Baldwin in England debating William F. Buckley in 1965. Jacqueline Rivers just got her PhD in sociology at Harvard after a young lifetime of listening, studying, experimenting in public and private education in Boston. Jacqueline Rivers, welcome back.
Thanks.
You've been to Missouri last month. I would love to hear you on the patterns you're seeing, old and new.
So I think the patterns in that people in Ferguson were talking about when I was there, some of it has to do with picking up on what Brandon was just talking about, the fact that St. Louis County is designed. It's not just Ferguson. St. Louis County is designed to exist by stopping and fining the residents who live there. Mm. However, the statistics reveal that it's disproportionately Black people who are stopped and fined. And so there's a pattern there which I think is in some sense reflective of the life that Black people face in the rest of the country. The other pattern that I saw there that spoke to me was a kind of determination to stand against the racial injustice. Now, I'm not endorsing rioting or looting, but you have got to admire the determination and the grit that brought these young people back to protest day after day after day for more than 3 months. They never missed a day. And what fueled them was not merely the murder of one individual, but a pattern of racial injustice and of white supremacy that they were facing every day in their everyday lives. And what concerns me, Chris, is not just the patterns in Ferguson, but the patterns across the country. So, of course, we saw just recently, I mean, just yesterday, the decision that came down in the Eric Garner grand jury, which declined to indict the officer who strangled him in a chokehold. But the New York Times today pointed out that there are actually six major cases. This isn't a complete listing of unarmed black men who died at the hands of the police between 2003 and 2014, and that in none of those cases did any officer actually serve time. In none of those cases. What is more, in 2014, across the country, we have five cases where unarmed black males, and I say males because one of these was not a man but a 12-year-old boy, died at the hands of police. And in the three cases which have gone through a grand jury process, no one has been indicted. So we have a major pattern here which operates at three levels. First of all, you have the police on the ground who are primed to see black men as dangerous and hostile merely by virtue of the color of their skin, regardless of their behavior, regardless of their size, regardless of the situation, they are dangerous. And secondly, we have prosecutors who operate in many cases more like defense lawyers than they do like prosecutors.
Meaning what?
Grand juries usually return whatever the prosecutor wants. Right. Normally, grand juries indict because prosecutors make a case that there is a reason to indict.
They can indict a ham sandwich, as they say.
So they say, right? Except if it's a white police officer who has killed a black man. In that case, you can get an indictment no matter what you do. You know, you really have to, except in the case of Fruitvale Station. The prosecutor in Oakland, he got his indictment. Which then brings me to the third level of the system, which is the way the judiciary operates. So the judiciary, it seems to me, has the most chilling role here. Because the judiciary, when a prosecutor is serious, as the prosecutor in Oakland was, downgrades the charges. In one case in New York City, where an indictment was brought and the officer was convicted, the judge sentenced him to probation and put the blame on the police force's failure to supervise and train. So what is more, Nancy Gertner had an excellent piece in the Boston Globe recently.
Retired judge in the federal court.
Exactly, and now on the faculty at Harvard Law School, had an excellent piece in which she says, look, this goes all the way to the Supreme Court. That 2 months before what happened in Ferguson, the Supreme Court found that officers who pursuing a car which they had stopped for having one headlight out, in the course of the pursuit, they fired 15 shots into the car, not only killed the driver, but his passenger. And the Supreme Court found that that was not excessive force. So the question it leaves us asking is, what is excessive force? And is there anything that an officer could do to a black man that the courts would find reasonable to punish? And there is one glimmer of hope that I see in this. Not only that black youth are standing up and saying no more, but that there seems to be a growing awareness among whites that there really is a systemic problem here that cannot be tolerated, that has to be addressed. Because consistently, there is a vast difference between how blacks see these cases and how whites see these cases.
Yes.
But these recent cases have been so egregious that whites are getting involved in protesting against them.
Jackie Rivers, I want to introduce Glenn Lowry, professor of economics at Brown. He joins us from Providence. He's been a prolific public intellectual across the board, but his South Side of Chicago roots feed all of it on manhood, on criminal justice, on American history. Glenn, welcome. You're on the alert about the new Jim Crow and especially about the all-time high incarceration rates of black men. Where are we going here?
I almost don't know what to say, Chris. A lot has already been said. I don't think, frankly, we're going anywhere with this vituperation. I mean, with the agitation around these, horrible and unfortunate events, with the outrage, I don't think it's going anywhere. I don't think it's reaching to the root of the problem, which I have to say, and I don't take any pleasure in saying it, is not the contempt and disregard for the humanity of African Americans by the police officers who are trying to secure public safety in the cities around the country. These incidents that have been pointed out, and there are others that could have been pointed out, are outrageous, and I don't object in any way to people being angry about them. But that is not, we are not living in the era in which James Baldwin was speaking of. The characters, the narrative characterization of the conditions of African Americans that has been put forward here, I don't think in any way accurately describes what's actually going on.
Describe it.
Michael Brown attacked that police officer. He was not hunted down by the Ku Klux Klan. The confrontations that we're finding between police and African Americans are taking place against a context of social disorder and insecurity, which, you know, it has its roots in various social conditions and so forth, but that's the reality of what's going on. I mean, the incident, for example, where the young man was accidentally shot to death in a stairwell in a public housing project in New York City just recently. Police officer, weapon discharges as he's opening a stairwell door. He has the weapon drawn and the safety is off. Now, why would he be entering the stairwell with a drawn weapon with the safety off? Because it's a dangerous place for him to go into. He's fearful for his life. Why is he patrolling a stairwell in a public housing project where there is no lighting in the stairwell? Because it's been a place where criminal activity has taken place. These situations are inevitable so long as you're sending police officers into these dangerous environments. I'm not making any excuses for their profiling. I'm not making any excuses for the racism which exists. But the conditions that are generating these horrible tragedies are rooted in, you know, a deep social structure of inequality. Yes, of course it ties to our history, and part of it is race, but it's not mainly race. These are not mainly racial. These are consequences of the social marginalization of people. More whites than blacks are killed by police officers in these fatal discharge of their weapons, and anyway, sorry.
I'm hearing a parallel to what Rudolph Giuliani was saying on the weekend. In effect, don't
Thanks,
blame
Chris.
The police. They're doing a difficult, dangerous job. And he said, maybe too crudely, it's your people that are creating the situation that in which these police have to do a dreadful job. But so where are you guiding us, though? I mean, I'm seeing so many structural roots.
Is that there are two things going on here. One of them is about public order. And the other is about the police treating the people whom they're serving and protecting with respect. So Ferguson, Missouri is a mess for the reasons that have been stated here and for others. The police reaped what they had sown in Ferguson, Missouri to the extent that they didn't enjoy any kind of trust or a positive relationship with the community in which they were working. Something horrible happened. The place blew up. The police bear a lot of the responsibility for that.
But Glenn, I want you to pick up on what Jackie was saying, and a lot of people have observed in comparable language about the structures of St. Louis County, which are built to take advantage of each other, and especially of Black people. I'm also thinking, frankly, of a really extraordinary piece that Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote in The Atlantic just a few months ago, and he described the world before Ferguson happened, but he was making the argument for reparations, which is always a tricky thing to do, but he was speaking of something more than recompense for old injustices. He said, rather, we need a national reckoning that would lead to spiritual renewal. And he's arguing that there has never been a general reckoning of our debt to slavery, not a whole lot of repentance, and no real uprooting of white supremacy as a mental habit. I mean, speak at that level, which it seems to me Ferguson is exposing.
We are 50 years past 1964, 50 years, a half century. Reparations? I mean, you have got to be kidding me, okay?
Well, I'm not kidding you, but I don't think Ta-Nehisi Coates is either.
No, I mean, with respect, I mean, of course, this is a narrative and this is an argument that will resonate. And of course, our history is lends itself readily to such drama. We're in the 21st century in a globalizing world. There are more Latinos, Hispanics than there are African Americans. The entire political dynamic is shifting. Silicon Valley is overrun with people of foreign-born and foreign-born parents, and not many of them are Black. Places like MIT and Caltech, the world is moving, and African Americans are being left behind. Now, we can continue with this lament. We can continue drawing up on the well of discontent and American dilemma.
It's
drama.
Not just discontent.
But the world is moving on. Believe me, nobody is moved by this. Political correctness in the air. Everybody pays homage to it, and they are moving on. And the one-third or one-quarter of the African-American community, which is not connected to the engine of opportunity, which is moving forward, are going to be left further and further behind. It's going to be a caste, not a racial issue, before too long.
Jacqueline Rivers, join the conversation at this level.
So, the question of reparations is, I think it was more a provocative statement than
seriously. He's not talking about
seriously.
5 acres and a mule. He's
exactly.
talking about the state of this, my head, maybe.
And in addition to that, he's really talking about how we transform what's happening in the inner cities and how we change the mass incarceration, some of which there are efforts afoot, changing drug laws, reforming prisons. These are things that need to be done because we have put Black men in a position where they are imprisoned at higher rates for minor drug offenses than whites are, even though whites use drugs at exactly the same comparable rates. So there has to be some kind of change at the structural level. And the first thing we have to do in order to make that happen is that we have to capture the imagination of middle America. We have to help them to see that there really are structural there are structures of racial injustice. That is not apparent to them. And one of the things that I hope for out of this horrible series of events is that that begins to become clear to middle America.
Yeah, I mean,
Brandon, Terry.
A couple of things. So I think one of the things that Professor Lowry brought up, which was really, really critical, is this question of trust, right? And that I'm enormously sympathetic, right? Now I'm on Harvard's campus. I see where the winds are blowing. Affirmative action is under assault again. Asian American groups are being recruited to the cause of dismantling affirmative action. The racial politics and the racial dynamics and demographics of this country are changing enormously, and it would be foolish to deny that. But there is a question about if black people are going to be left behind, how do we diagnose why that might be the case, and how do we respond so that it's not the case? And one of the questions is trust. And if people don't feel like their trust in the mainstream civic institutions of this society is repaid, then they're not going to participate and attempt to achieve their forms of human flourishing through those institutions. These are questions of trust. And one of the sort of rules of thumb that I have for policing is that no police officer should do anything that makes every other police officer in the country's job harder the next day.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Through the dark lens of Ferguson, Missouri and Chokehold, New York, through the racism embedded in our history and generations of toxic effects on all of us, where do we look for light? With our guests, Glenn Lowry, Jacqueline Rivers, Brandon Terry, here is the voice of the St. Louis rapper, Tef Poe. By now the acclaimed street poet and protest leader of Ferguson, he was a big hit at Stanford University late in October. He's got a standing invitation to appear at Harvard. Is there a forward vision in sounds like this?
My mama told me they gon' kill me any day. I'm revolutionary minded anyway. My mama told me they gon' kill me any day. I'm revolutionary minded anyway. They told me all I rap.
I want to look further at that vision and sparks of creative protest or whatever. But Glenn, stick with me for just one moment on the Cornel West vision of nihilism in black America, which still moves me. He says he's talking about structures, he's talking about behaviors and culture of self-destruction. But then he says, third and most important, we must delve into the murky waters of despair and dread that now flood the streets of black America. To talk about the depressing statistics of unemployment, infant mortality, incarceration, teenage pregnancy, and violent crime is one thing. But to face up to the monumental eclipse of hope, the unprecedented collapse of meaning, the incredible disregard for human, especially black life and property in much of black America is something else. He's talking hope and meaning and love and where in the world they will be found again. Glenn, it's your turn.
Well, I mean, that's why people are still reading, Race Matters all these many years later. Brother Cornel West touches on the spiritual dimension, the existential dimension, and on the extent to which the weight of these generations of oppression that have been alluded to in this conversation tonight, that weight bears down on individuals, and it damages their souls. It leaves them reduced, so that what issues forth can be ugly, and it can be endangering to people who are around, and it can be self-destroying. And it points toward the need for a transformation, not at the material level, not a check that comes from somewhere, or even a program, but at the spiritual and at the existential level, a rebirth, a kind of transformative intervention that presumably won't be the result of government activity, but would be the result of people being led, presumably by others who are dedicated to the task, to see themselves in an entirely new way. I mean, so it's Baldwin-esque and all of that. I mean, no problem with it. This guy, Glenn Lowry, who was ranting just a minute ago, is all in with Cornell in this project of recognizing and then remedying the spiritual vacancy, which the oppression of black people over all these years has wrought. But that I'm still coming out where I came out with respect to Ferguson, but I want to make that acknowledgement.
But what's the trap you're worried about?
I'm sorry.
What's the? Are you warning us about a spiritual trap? What is the caution?
No, I mean, you asked me to reflect on West's recitation about nihilism in the black community, and that's what I thought that I was doing. So I'm not sure I know what you refer to here.
No, go. Yeah, go.
So
Jacqueline Rivers.
So I couldn't agree with Glenn more on this. In fact, I think Chris, you know that we put a lot of time in our lives, my husband and I, to actually addressing some of these spiritual issues. And if you look For us, it's about the Christian tradition, and it's about really helping people recognize that there is hope because there is a God who is in charge. But if you look to that Christian tradition, what goes hand in hand with that spiritual transformation is material actions,
yes,
concrete actions that change the quality of people's lives. And so as a part of that, what we did was to work right here in Boston against violence, especially among youth in inner city neighborhoods. And there was a moment when things were really making a difference, when resources were going into prevention and intervention for youth, getting them involved in things that address some of those needs of the soul, that addressed the need for fraternity without having to get involved with a criminal gang or violent gang in order to have that sense of fraternity. But along came 9/11, and resources were redirected into anti-terrorist work and the militarization of the police and the it's less of a problem here in Boston, but we saw the effect even here in Boston. And certainly it was demonstrated very clearly on the streets of Ferguson recently. That militarization of the police says to people, you cannot trust these institutions. It says to people, you cannot invest your efforts in trying to do well in school because there's nothing out there for you.
Right. And part of hope is, in a democratic society, is being able to see your aims and purposes realized through political action, right? To see the society you live in reflect the things that you can care about, including the people that you care about. And so when you have a society like Ferguson, where the government, you can't even participate because every time you would go, if you go to the courthouse to register to vote, you're likely to be picked up on one of the three warrants that are out on your house. I mean, this is not, you know, what breeds more nihilism than that? I mean, that's where you see people say, well, I don't want to participate in these formal politics. Like, I'm not about these kinds of mainstream institutions. I don't believe that the school is invested in me. And so for any response to deal with these spiritual elements, it also has to be political. It has to be material.
Absolutely.
People are dealing with poverty.
But
they're
that's sort of the genius of the Black church tradition, too. You remind me of my pastor, Michael, the great Michael E. Haynes. He likes to say, Lord, don't let me be so heavenly minded that I'm
no earthly good.
And it's true. Jackie.
I think the other thing is, you know, the voice of my 27-year-old son is also resounding in my head, where he says to me, it's not just about despair and anger and rage against injustice. It's also that thug life has been glamorized, that there is a pull to it because it looks glamorous. It's a fast life. It looks like these guys have everything going for them. And one of the things that Cornell talks about in that essay is the role of the market economy. And Black men, Deva Page has done research that shows that Black men not only come out of this mass incarceration unable to get jobs and suffering at a disadvantage compared to white men who also have been incarcerated, but in addition to that, they're at a disadvantage. If you take a Black man who does not have a prison record, he is less likely to get a call back for a job interview than a white man who does have a prison record. So on one hand, a Black man can't get a decent job, but on the other hand, he can be paid millions to rap about violence, to rap about misogyny. There's something really wrong and broken here because the society at large is glamorizing the nihilism and the thug behavior that comes out of it.
But I do.
Brandon Terry.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to some of these claims. It's just that I don't want it to overshadow the fact that we also have to make decisions about a society, as a society, about how to respond, right? So when we throw around like ideas like public order, criminal activity, we have to be very precise about what it is that we mean when we say those things. When we talk about thug life, we do have to be sort of careful in that not everything deserves the same kind of response, right? And I think this is another thing about the Black church tradition that's really, really powerful, is that people make mistakes, and there's other answers besides punishment, putting people in cages, locking people away, sending them away from their families, taxing their families with all of these crazy prison regulations where they're charging you.
When you come out, you owe the state for...
Right, or your family's getting charged exorbitant rates to call you. The food is so terrible that your family's got to pay $3 and $4 for one cup of oodles and noodles just to keep you alive for another day. I mean, these are all things that we've got to decide as a society, that because a bunch of guys are smoking reefer in a stairwell in Brooklyn, that might not demand us to walk down the stairwell with our guns drawn, right?
Glenn, your turn to testify.
Well, I mean, just on that, I assume it's not the reefer smokers who they're concerned about when they draw the guns. But I don't want to get in that. I want to go back to something that was said at the beginning of this conversation that I thought was spot on. It had to do with the implications, the profound implications of the split-screen imaging on the night that the grand jury's verdict in Ferguson, Missouri was announced, of the president addressing the nation on this matter, and at the same time of the public disorder, I'm not sure quite what else one can call it, that was ensuing by people in the aftermath. And I think that that will actually resonate down through the ages in a way. And I do think that it kind of pulled the covers off of some stuff. Yeah, some of it has to do with the wide gulf between the expectations that accompanied Barack Obama's ascendancy to the president of the United States in 2008, presidency of the United States in 2008, in the hearts and minds of a great many African Americans, our time has come, and so forth and so on. The juxtaposition between that on the one hand and the relative impotency of that man, that same man, in the office of president of the United States to be able to make the, you know, engine of government address and redress the concerns, the real concerns in the lives of those people. I'm not faulting the president for his inability to do that. He's been hamstrung and he's been hemmed in, and he's not a dictator, as he has told us, to simply wave a wand and make everything different. But those expectations were, you know, understandable but unrealistic. I think we have to all say that. He was occupying the office of the presidency of the United States, was just the chief cheerleader for the American, you know, military empire flung around the globe, and the chief cheerleader for Wall Street and corporate interest. And that's what the presidency of the United States is. That's the office that he was seeking. It's the one that he occupied. It was never going to be, you know, a key to open the door for African Americans. But of course, people are disappointed in that. But the juxtaposition, and I'll finish, between that on the one hand, and the disorder that ensued after that unpopular grand jury verdict on the other. And the president, I thought, was diminished by that moment, and not just because cable television chose to split a screen. He was diminished by the gulf between his responsibilities in the office as the chief of law and order. He is the embodiment of the institutions that we're railing against here, on the one hand, and this kind of narrative biography of African-American ascendancy, which he personifies, on the other. The myth of that embodiment, which was always disconnected from political reality, finally caught up with him, in a sense, when disorder broke out. What the chief law enforcement officer of the country is supposed to do is not understand rioters and split the difference. What he's supposed to do is stand for law and order. That's his job. the fact of the president trying to split the difference between these two things, sociologist in chief, understander of the empathy and pain, having once been a young black man himself on the one hand, legal officer of the highest order, the chief administrator of the American state on the other, was palpable in those images.
Glenn, that is very well said. I want to come back, though. I want to change the subject in what time we have, back to Tef Poe and the creative activism that we've heard a lot about, hip-hop, street art. What do we make of the aesthetics of this Ferguson time, Brandon Terry?
Well, so two things. I mean, one, I just want to, as a brief addition to Glenn's comment, I just want to make sure that we don't forget that law and order also includes the police, right?
It also includes justice.
Right, and following, and they need to follow the law as well. So that's part of the, I mean, that's, I think that's part of the ambivalence. But the creative activism of the moment, what's really inspiring to me, and this is the only, I mean, I think all intelligent, skeptical readers of American history have to be well aware that the weight of history, the weight of the structural inertia of American institutions is against this movement. That's obviously true. But what heartens me, what gives me hope, is that I think for the very, very first time in a long time, these protesters, these young people, are thinking back about the purpose of protest. For too long, protest has been kind of like civil rights revival theater. People sort of dress up in the same garments. They try to quote the same words. They hold the signs solemnly and march, but they forget that protest is an answer to a particular question. And the question is about injustice, and it's how do you respond? And all protest has to be able to be provocative, has to be pedagogical, and it has to be political, right? Mm-hmm. It's got to be able to stop the regularity, the ordinary life of people around them to get them to pay attention, not let an injustice drown in the unfolding of daily life to appear regular and natural and something we can't do anything about. It's got to be pedagogical in that it needs to teach people what the injustice is and how to understand it and how we might do something about it. It needs to be political in terms of being tied to a real platform and program of action.
Jackie Rivers.
The other thing is that I talked earlier about the fact that, you know, society will pay black men millions to rap about violence. But the other side of rap is that rap was at the heart. It was a big part of the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. That people in North Africa were listening to rap music with the kinds of messages about freedom and justice which made a difference in their lives. And if we can recapture some of the artistic power, some of the brilliance of our rap artists to put it to use in terms of opening the eyes of young people and perhaps even of middle America to the injustices, then this is truly a worthwhile, you know, I don't want to be Pollyannish and say, oh, yes, you know, ride on to victory. I'm just saying maybe there's some hope here.
I wish we'd spend a whole hour on the civil rights movement, what we have to learn again from the civil rights movement, but also you seem to be suggesting, Brandon, what we've got to let go of and we've got to move on in a new way. Never enough time. This is a huge subject. We will come back to it. We're enormously grateful to all of you for sharing very, very openly. And that's you, including you too, my man, Glenn Lowry. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you, Brandon Terry. Thank you, Jackie Rivers. Thanks also to the hip-hop historian Jeff Chang at Stanford University. We will continue this conversation. Next time, we'll tune in on some of the hip-hop soundtrack of a new youth movement in America. Add your own voice, please, at radioopensource.org. There's more on our website, including a Harper's Index of the racial divide in this country and a lab experiment that you can take on your own. We're going out on Sing About Me by Kendrick Lamar.
And I love you cause you love my brother like you did. Just promise me you tell this story when you make it big. And if I die before your album drop, I hope. Promise that you will sing about me, promise that you will sing about me. I said when the lights shut off and it's my turn to settle down, my main concern. Promise that you will sing about me, promise that you will sing about me.
Our show is produced by Connor Gillies and Max Larkin with help from Rebecca Panovka and Maria Jose Fabre. Our engineer is George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.